Welcome to Sacred Lines, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the University of Colorado Center for Media, Religion, and Culture. Sacred Lines explores the complex intersections of religion and the media. Today, we embark on an exploration of the way icons are created through the media and what it means to be an icon. I'm your host, Samira Rajabi.
And I'm your host, Art Bamford. In this episode, we explore the making and cementing of a pop culture icon, Oprah Winfrey. Oprah has been many things in our pop culture landscape, and it is hard to pin her down as just one kind of celebrity or public figure. From these many descriptions of her, we can see that Oprah is a step above the run-of-the-mill celebrity. When I think of the word icon in a religious setting, the first thing that comes to mind is the Greek Orthodox Church that has a rich history of visual icons. Different from an idol, something that is prayed to, an icon is more of a tool for the observer to meditate on and to help direct spiritual thoughts.
In academic circles, Oprah has been called many things. Authors Webb and Wagner noted that she was on a spiritual mission, while other authors feature her rags-to-riches story, and her philanthropy is proof that her motivation has never been material wealth, but a love of her work, and in fact, a love of people. Oprah is set up as more than the general celebrity, businesswoman, or life coach. She is all of the above and more. She is thought to have the Midas touch and a way with humanity. As Catherine Lofton noted, there is something rather religious about Oprah Winfrey. With this in mind, we wanted to find out more. How is it that Oprah became the icon that she is? How is it that she created a revolution that brings together spiritual and life counsel with mindfulness and a strong influence of capitalism? What is it about Oprah that draws us in?
So we delve deep into Oprah's life. We explored her history and some of her most prominent media moments. Oprah Winfrey started in television in Baltimore in 1976, opening the doors for her to be recruited by a Chicago TV station to host her own morning show. Oprah later transitioned to host her wildly popular daytime program from 1986 to 2011. Oprah, with national syndication, built her show into a powerful empire, owning the rights to her program and starting her own production company. We explore some of her greatest media moments here today.
We also talked to two scholars who have spent considerable time researching the legend herself. Catherine Lofton is a professor at Yale University in the Department of Religious Studies and the author of the book Oprah, The Gospel of an Icon.
And Janice Peck, who is a professor at the University of Colorado in the newly formed College of Media, Communication, and Information. She also wrote a book on Oprah called Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era. We asked them both about the phenomenon that is Oprah Winfrey and about what they are doing now. Here's Janice Peck.
Well, I mean, I think in terms of the idea of an icon, it's that it's somebody who is much more than an individual. I mean, it's a mediated public persona, and that the persona begins to take on attributes that exalt and hold them up as a special case of human, and they come to represent a whole kind of series of powerful meanings, so that if you think of, you know, so that, you know, sayings, Oprah developed a whole bunch of little sayings like an aha moment. An icon is somebody, a mediated personality, a public personality that can shape the culture in ways that go far beyond, you know, kind of one simple thing as a talk show host, so that she, you know, she becomes this kind of iconic figure. So we see people referring to her as the relationship she has with her followers is the relationship to a flock, that the followers and her message are almost a religion, you know, and live your best life. So all kinds of phrases enter into the public dialogue by means of this one figure who comes to represent something far beyond simply a woman whose name is Oprah Winfrey, who lives someplace. She's now, you know, an iconic figure. And there are other figures like that, but she is one of them.
Here's Catherine telling us a bit about what she does in an interview I conducted with her.
In general, I am a person who has put a lot of time into thinking about what it means to name the religious and whether or not the United States is a unique or a familiar incarnation of certain forms of religion. And I've been doing that for about 20 years, ever since I started college. I moved very quickly from being somebody who thought I was going to be pre-med to to somebody who became incredibly committed to the question of the relationship between political activity in the United States and religious feeling and participation. Presently, besides doing way too many bureaucratic meetings and interactions, I'm kind of thinking about two major problems. The life and times of Robert Zimmerman, a.k.a. Bob Dylan, and his sort of figure as a way to think about the history of religions over the last 65 years. And secondly, I'm working on a shorter-term project on the Goldman Sachs Group and how their workplace life, but also their public role and public symbolism has played into certain conversations and questions about what it means to name value in contemporary capitalist culture. But the long way of getting at that, my intersecting interests are both bureaucratic and capitalist and political, but also I'm really interested in the things that we think supersede those forms sometimes. That is charismatic authority, that we think that sometimes particular people seem to supersede the roles of capitalism and politics. And in my book on Oprah, I kind of say that is true and untrue. It is the case that she defied all odds, but she also was very much an instrument of her economic and political time.
And here's Janice Peck from CU Boulder telling us a bit about herself and her connection to Oprah.
I am interested and study all kinds of phenomena that come at the intersection of very U.S.-focused, I must say, U.S. culture, politics, history, and media, and the ways in which those things interact with each other.
So how does your study that you did several years back of Oprah fit into those research interests?
Well, I mean, that study grew out of the kind of work I'd been doing before. So I began when I was a doctoral student in the 80s getting very interested in that intersection, because what was rising at the time was televangelism. And so all kinds of religious television and religious media at the same time that we saw the politics, the rise of the religious right and the kind of that intersection. So how I got to Oprah... And that's where we're going, that's where we're heading, is because when I was looking at Robertson, I really got interested in the question of media forms. And so the talk show was fascinating to me. It's like, well, where does this come from? And what relationship can it establish with people that's different than other forms of television? And so when I was through and I started work as an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota, that was at kind of 89 and into the 90s, and what we saw during that period was this explosion of television talk shows, daytime, nighttime, really a huge proliferation, and not simply religious, but all over the place. And kind of coming out of kind of the foundation of it had been Phil Donahue, but we began to see more and more people get into that field, and Winfrey as well in the 80s. Mid-80s starts to become, you know, one of the people who are known as the kind of prominent talk show host. So in the 90s, there was this enormous proliferation. And at the same time during this period, we began to see this kind of taking off, proliferation of a therapeutic orientation, all of this self-help, all of these 12-step groups, kind of an increasing emphasis on thinking about the world through the lens of the therapeutic. And the talk shows were doing the same thing. They would have these experts from the field of psychology come and help dysfunctional people. So that's how I got to talk shows. And I did work on talk shows in general. And increasingly, I became more and more interested in Oprah Winfrey because she was becoming not just one of many talk show hosts, but being transformed into something different. And so I ended up writing a book that describes her, and I drew language from popular media representations as a cultural icon. And I wanted to understand, how is it that she became this kind of an entity and was being described by people as almost a religion in terms of her relationship with her followers? She was using not just therapeutic discourse, but increasingly kind of discourses of spirituality. And so in a sense, I kind of moved from religious television to television talk shows to the most famous talk show host, not only in the U.S., but increasingly internationally, who was drawing on kind of this spiritual history and media. And that was a very long answer to your question, but I figured it would help you understand how I got where I got to.
So we get a glimpse of the history of Oprah, and Oprah truly was one of the most famous talk show hosts out there, with some of the most iconic moments in television and pop culture history. Let's talk about some of her greatest media moments now.
Absolutely, Samira. Remember her sensational appearance in 1988? Oprah shocked audiences when, in a mere matter of months, she lost 67 pounds, which she pulled out behind her in a wagon to represent the amount of weight that she had lost. The weight would not stay off, however, as just 2 weeks later, she had already gained back 10 of the pounds that she had lost. What moments do you remember, Samira?
I'll never forget that interview with Tom Cruise. It was historic. He, in a fit of happiness, jumped up on the couch.
That was May of 2005. Oprah hosted one of her most memorable interviews to date. Tom Cruise graced the set and spoke with Oprah about his newfound love for Hollywood star Katie Holmes. One can hardly forget seeing Cruise light up the stage and play wildly to the audience's cheers of encouragement as he publicly celebrated by jumping up and down on the couch and stretching his arms above his head in triumph. Cruise spent the majority of the interview in excited laughter over his newfound happiness.
That sure was an iconic moment, Art. Her show was more than just a space for celebrities to exalt their fame. Every move Oprah made was scrutinized. Everything she did became sacred. And not just sacred, but complicated. Here's Catherine again, explaining the way Oprah was both a point of research for her, but also a marker of our consumer culture.
You know, I think that there is a big divide in the field on that question. The field here being, could be defined itself in a couple different ways. I think one of the most annoying things about being a humanist is also the thing that we give the world, which is, while the world moves along with its words and its anxieties, humanists stop people at every word and say, what does that word mean? So right away, I want to say something to you, Samira, about, well, the study of religion. What's the study of religion? Is the study of religion marked by an institution, the American Academy of Religion? Is it marked by people who are in yeshiva, taking seriously texts that we've marked as religious? Is it the ways in which Oprah followers still write me, asking me whether or not I have read X or Y spiritual volume that she recommended on the Oprah Winfrey Network, her Super Soul Sundays, and whether or not I think that that form of spiritual insight is true or untrue. So which one of those things are religious? Your question is the right one, which is, who's in charge of deciding that? And any given moment, I can feel sympathetic to the role the speaker plays in naming the religious. So whatever the speaker would be, whether it's the Supreme Court, it's an undergraduate student I work with, or it's an agency like the American Academy of Religion or the American Association for the Study of Religion, these sort of academic bodies that by sheer fact of taking up an object seem to be saying something about whether or not they're religious. In my own work, I would say that I'm chasing the religious as I move on. I used to be quite interested in that question. I think increasingly I'm more interested in talking about value and moments where you see people trying to differentiate and make hierarchies of value. And I think that there's no question that that's partially related to the time that I spent in the wake of the Oprah Book Project talking to people who don't necessarily have any academic affiliation, but who felt the question of Oprah's religiosity was axiomatic. So the thing that still is being fought out in obscure small conference rooms where 8 people are in attendance, but whether or not it's right to use the word religion, I would go and give talks at Rotary clubs, at churches, at synagogues. You know, people just offering, I want to talk about, you know, we heard about your book, we just want to talk about. And they took it as a given that Oprah was a religious figure. They had no questions about that. Indeed, when I would raise that question, they would just see the very fact that we had questions about the nature of the religious as another sign that the university was so out of touch with the actuality of human interpretation and experience. What they wanted to talk about was, so what does it mean? What does it mean that she has a sway in people's life, an effect on the decisions they make? What will always be very moving to me, I was a younger scholar when I was first talking about Oprah, and I was highly sensitive, and you know, whenever I got criticism or questions that sounded critical, I would feel both anxious but also a need to rise up to that anxiety and not be defeated by it. But when I think back now, the questions that I got around the Oprah Project were relatively unquestioning of a scholarly posture towards this person that focused a lot on the question of consumer culture. So I would have audiences filled with women, women of color, middle-class women, poor women, who would come out to all different kinds of contexts, academic and non, to speak about somebody they felt very passionately about. And they had really strong, and in that passion, they were not uncritical. They were ferociously critical, but they could not stop consuming. So the thing that they would ask me questions about was the nature of that almost addictive letter level of consumption, even as they felt, yeah, I'm racking up credit card bills, and I'm still in this abusive relationship, and I'm still feeling the freight of beauty culture, yet I can't stop watching her, even though I know she's just re-injecting me with my own anxiety. So they would acknowledge, see it, and I just think back to those audiences of women, and always women, who were very passionate, and frankly, almost, I would say, in a way that I found very familiar in the years of working on their project, a little bit ashamed about their level of consumption of her. Like, it's not, they felt, and I would always try to redeem their shame and say, there's no shame in it. I mean, Oprah is everywhere and there's good reasons and she has good, but there would be this kind of anxiety of the shopper's anxiety, a little embarrassed, not feeling great, really proud. What's notable from that kind of both gendered space of anxiety about consumer culture, an anxiety that's so beautifully recorded in work like Ann Douglas's The Feminization of American Culture.
Catherine is not the only one that felt this complicated relationship with Oprah. Many consumers are entwined in the consumer culture that Oprah promotes.
That's right, Art. In fact, Oprah has been described as a lot of things. Icon, celebrity, guru. But this holiday season, the website Pop Sugar crowned her a benevolent holiday gift goddess. Why? Because since 2002, Oprah has been unveiling her favorite things for her fans to covet, buy, and share in as part of a gift-giving and getting bonanza. The familiar you get a gift, and you get a gift, and everybody gets a gift has become a pop culture meme. On this year's list, a $150 nail lacquer wardrobe created by Butter London just for Oprah, $13 antlers for your dog affixed to a $13 beanie, and a drizzle cake from Carousel Cakes.
This idea that you can better your life through consumer culture at the behest of one woman is precisely what we are trying to understand in this episode. We hope to explore this further in our second half. You're listening to Sacred Lines on KGNU, a collaboration with the University of Colorado's Center for Media, Religion, and Culture. I'm Art Bamford.
And I'm Samir Rajabi. We've been talking about Oprah Winfrey and the ways in which she has come to be a quasi-spiritual religious figure, an icon of sorts, to masses of individuals around the world. Her popular talk show, Super Soul Sunday, which began in October of 2011 and has now entered its sixth season, provides a quasi-religious space for viewers to come and explore ideas concerning topics such as spirituality, the afterlife, and personal fulfillment. The Super Soul Sunday website claims that the program is, quote, designed to help viewers awaken to their best selves and discover a deeper connection to the world around them. The show builds a religious space in which viewers can learn to understand themselves through Oprah's experiences and conversations. Janice Peck, in our recent interview, described to us the way the so-called cult of Oprah was also the cult of self. And she also helps us understand why Oprah, rather than any other cultural figure, rose to prominence.
I was trying to understand, well, what is the nature of her appeal? And why does she appeal to the sector of the population that she does? And how can I understand that appeal historically and contextually? So I was trying to make sense of what is going on in the world that produced, to be honest with you, Oprah Winfrey and me as, you know, I mean, she's 2 years younger than me. We're both boomers. We lived through many of the same developments. And so I thought, well, I want to understand, you know, the world that has produced both of us, including the fact that people like me are her major followers, but that also I am in that demographic and I am asking all of these questions about her. And so I kind of got there that way. And I knew that there was a relationship between kind of the history, the religious history, and the religious media history that I had already understood part of. I knew there was a relationship to the kind of the rise of all of these self-help groups, the recovery movement, the fact that almost everybody I knew at a certain point, and again, I'm situating myself as female, of a certain age, a certain social class. Almost everybody I knew was reading self-help books or going to groups of some kind. How did this happen, and what's the relationship of that to the women's movement? Because a lot of the same language got used, but increasingly, I remember reading somebody that I thought this is like resonated for me, where she was talking about the transition from the movement for women's liberation and women's equality and women's political rights to this movement, this like mass migration of women into kind of self-help and therapy, and saying, you know, it used to be women said, I'm angry, and now they're saying, I'm sick. And I thought there's a historical political explanation to be looked for here, because it was part of the backlash against feminism, the rise of Reagan, the rise of the right, the movement into this idea that the self, the individual, is responsible for all of her problems or his problems, that you can fix things by fixing the self. And I thought, okay, I want to understand this, because it's a depoliticization, or it's a movement of the political into the personal and the psychological. So I kept remembering the coming out of the women's movement is like that it made the personal political. And I felt like what I was seeing is turning the political into nothing but the personal. So all of my interest in history and politics and religion and feminism and, you know, media came together. And I thought this figure, as a historical figure, as a media figure, will allow me to study and understand and ask the questions that I'm interested in far beyond how come Oprah's popular.
Oprah's popularity wasn't restricted to the run of her show. Just last year, the Life You Want Weekend was Oprah's endeavor into evangelizing TV audiences in person. In 2014, Oprah traveled to 8 U.S. cities on her Life You Want Weekend tour. The object of her tour was to provide her audiences with what she calls a gratitude space, where they can fulfill their greatest potential, find their calling, and have the courage to live it. She took the stage with a number of other inspirational leaders and sought to instill in the viewers lessons that she claims are core to her success. Lessons like, when life speaks, listen, you get to choose your thoughts, and you become what you believe. Fans from across the U.S. flocked to her tour, selling out shows.
Even before the Life You Want tour, Oprah managed to reach out of her televisions into people's hearts and minds through the magic of books. In 1996, Oprah expanded her empire to include a book club. Like everything else Oprah recommended, the books on her book list turned to gold, selling millions and millions of copies. In 2011, after 70 recommendations, the book club reached the end of its road. Before coming to an end, in 2005, Oprah helped to launch the book A Million Little Pieces by author James Frey to the top of the New York Times bestsellers list for 15 weeks straight. However, after the book became popular, it came to light that the alleged memoir was, in fact, at least semi-fictional, resulting in a backlash against Oprah. In 2006, once these allegations came to light, Oprah invited Frey onto her show and confronted him for the way he deceived her and the millions of viewers. Frey admitted on air to lying about several of the details in the book. Years later, Oprah would have Frey on her show again to apologize for the way that she confronted him. So she recommends books and products, but many are curious. Does she do that to help people, or is it for the paycheck?
I often get the question, though, do you think she really means it, or how much of this is just her clever use of the culture industry to get everyone to buy the products that just keep making them trying to solve a problem in themselves that they can never really solve through products? And I guess I want to say is Oprah is just ended up finding a way to tell the story of herself in a way that is very compelling. She's taken the particular tale of herself and made it a source of endless advice, so that her ability to make her particularity something universal and her unabashed desire to make her universal the subject of this multimedia revolution, that's her genius. But it's a genius that we all have access to. That's why it's so resonant, which is her narrative of I turn to myself is the story she has of her own success, the way she got out of difficult circumstances in her childhood, got out of Nashville, got out of Baltimore, got every single story she tells about herself is riven with, and then I knew. When I wasn't successful, it was because I didn't go with my instincts. Now, I think the job of the liberal arts, the job of the humanities and the social sciences and the biological sciences is to teach people that they are of a species of problem, and that the way that you think is just about you is actually culturally constituted. And I do wish that Oprah could a lot more often, but I also wish that of all my colleagues. I wish that all the colleagues I know who give advice would see themselves as a part of a broader social culture of which their exceptional tale is itself often very culturally constituted. The thing I hear the most from graduate students right now is that the kind of market culture we're in for jobs is so bad and so unlike the culture for jobs in previous years. And any historian worth their salt will say the same. You know, academics will say, oh, the 80s was just as bad, you just don't know. The statistics do not bear that out. The bottom line is, to understand yourself as a social subject and not just a solo, endeavoring, authenticating subject is one of the hardest things for human beings to do. Oprah did not really do it. She just chose to tell this tale of her own success as the tale of yours. I think we all are often victim of that same kind of solipsistic autobiography. And the question for all of us is how to turn ourselves and see ourselves as species.
All of these Oprah moments, they made us wonder, in looking at this woman, this powerhouse, this legend, what exactly is it about Oprah? How did she build this empire? How did she build herself into an icon that we all want to follow? We talked to Janice Peck about this very question and whether or not Oprah knew that her pop theology espoused a combination of self-help, hope, and consumerism.
So when we think about our notions of consumerism and self-help and those being tied together, do you think she deliberately promotes that consumerism, or do you think it's just a byproduct of kind of that depoliticization that happened over time?
Both. And not that I think that Winfrey sits around in an office and says, how can I promote consumerism? Because nothing works that way. But the values that she possesses herself, that she embodies, that she promotes, I mean, I think those are values that she genuinely believes are good, and she sees them as, and beneficial, and she sees them as, you know, I mean, you know, you deserve to be happy. You deserve to have these things. At the same time, I think we can't deny that that orientation makes her a very advertiser-friendly figure. And her media empire is very advertising-friendly. And that has been the case from the beginning. I mean, when I first started writing about her, before she became iconic, before she became somebody who, it seemed, you know, the Midas touch. I mean, the kinds of phrases used about her ability to be successful. I mean, when she was at her peak, you know, and basically around 2005, 2006, she was seen, I mean, there were people in the media industries that were talking about her in using phrases as everything she touches turns to gold. It was phenomenal. The launch of her magazine was the most successful launch of a magazine in the history of magazines in the U.S. I mean, the incredible kind of emphasis. And so enormous money making. I mean, this is how she has become one of the world's richest people, you know, in the top 400 richest people on the planet individually, was through the, you know, how friendly she is to a world that does emphasize consumption, that doesn't criticize in any kind of fundamental way that the world is organized. I mean, when we look at the massive redistribution of wealth, Winfrey is one of the, you know, not just the 1%, the, you know, 1/10, 1/100th of 1% of people in the world. And her enormous wealth is part of that redistribution. Changes in the tax structure, for example, all kinds of movement of money into certain kinds of places, which allow people like her or Bill Gates, beneficiaries of all of these political economic developments and changes in the way that capitalism operates worldwide, means that they have enormous wealth. And the transfer of wealth from the public sector to the private sector then allows them to be philanthropists with their enormous wealth and to say, well, I'm going to support this, and I'm going to be for education, and I'm going to, you know, support private schools. But they're not beholden. We don't elect these people. They're not answerable to any kind of, you know, to citizenry. They can decide, I have all of this money, and this is the way that I'm going to fund things. And, you know, Winfrey and Gates's funding of education, for example, is all organized around privatization, funding charter schools. I mean, they're not coming back and saying, well, what we want to do is to improve the public education system. We should be taxed more, so there's more public money that goes in to support public schools in poorer school districts and so on. So I don't think that she plots, but at the same time, the values, the dominant values we see in the culture are her values. And she has no reason to question them. I mean, she's extraordinarily successful.
You've been listening to Sacred Lines, a quarterly show on KGNU in collaboration with the University of Colorado's Center for Media, Religion, and Culture, exploring the intersections of religion and the media. You can listen to this episode, find out more, and hear our full interviews at cmrc.colorado.edu and at kgnu.org. We'd like to thank today's guests, Dr. Catherine Lofton, Dr. Janice Peck. Today's show was produced by William Ramsey, Patrick Johnson, Ryan Bartlett, Brad Brighton, and myself with Maeve Conran. I've been your host, Samir Ajabi.
And I've been your host, Art Bamford.